This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 50 years ago today, on July 18, 1969, Senator Ted Kennedy drove a black Oldsmobile off the Dyke Bridge into the water of Poocha Pond in Chappaquiddick. In the car were the senator and a young woman named Mary Jo Kopechne, a staffer who had worked on Robert Kennedy's campaign. They were coming from a party with some of Kennedy's friends and a group of young women now known as the Boiler Room Girls. Ted Kennedy relayed his version of the events of that night in a televised speech just about a week after the accident on July 25th, 1969.
The car overturned in a deep pond and immediately filled with water. I remember thinking as the cold water rushed in around my head that I was for certain drowning. Then water entered my lungs and I actually felt the sensation of drowning. But somehow I struggled to the surface alive. I made immediate and repeated efforts to save Mary Jo by diving into the strong and murky current, but succeeded only in increasing my state of utter exhaustion and alarm.
Mary Jo Kopechne died in the car. She was 28 years old. Kennedy did not report the accident to the police for 10 hours. On the island, Edgartown's chief of police, Jim Arena, received a call from the cottage closest to the bridge, occupied by the Malm family. Jim Arena, who passed away in March, was the first law enforcement officer on the scene. He spoke with Liz McNeil for People Magazine's podcast on Chappaquiddick, Cover Up, about what he did when he arrived at the bridge.
I did some crazy thing. I went into the Malm's cottage, which was located right near there, and I asked if her husband had a bathing suit, and I changed into my bathing suit, and I left my gun and everything else in there, and I swam out to the car. I was fighting the tide, and I had no eyeglasses or anything else or water safety glasses, and I couldn't see inside anyway. I placed myself on top of the car, and I sat there when another officer from Edgartown arrived, Bob Bruguer.
At that time, Bob Bruguer was a summer patrolman for the Edgartown Police. He spoke with us about his memory of what happened next.
Well, Jim was sitting on the bumper of the car, and the bumper was only out of the water an inch or two. He, of course, had taken off his uniform, and he had a T-shirt on and a purple bathing suit that belonged to Mr. Malm. And Jim read to me the license plate number, and I called it in on the police cruiser radio to Barnstable 376, which was their call letters. And about 15 or 20 minutes later, they called me back to say the car was registered to Edward M. Kennedy in Boston. Well, I had a shiver that went up my spine that I would never forget. And I got out of the car and yelled over to Jim, the car belonged to the Senator Kennedy. He said, the world is going to descend upon us, and it did.
As the world began to descend upon you, or even in those moments when you were experiencing the chill from realizing whose car it was, what went through your mind? How did you react?
First of all, I was a summer policeman. I was a high school teacher at Natick High School at the time, and we had no training whatsoever, none. The three selectmen signed a little piece of paper appointing you a police officer. They gave you a gun and five bullets, and there was no other training whatsoever.
How were you first notified to go to the bridge, and what were you expecting to see or not expecting to see when you got there?
Well, I had just come on duty that morning at 8 o'clock, and coming out of the police station, which was in two tiny rooms in the town hall, and another police officer, a summer police officer, Roy Meekins, and I exited the building onto Main Street at the same time. And Tony Silva, the chief, the fire chief at the time, drove up and rolled down his window, and he said, Jim Arena needs another man over on Chappaquiddick. So I reached in my pocket and took out a quarter and flipped the quarter, and I won the toss. So I rode over to Chappie with Tony Silva, and when I got there, you know, Jim was on the bumper of the car in the water, and I had no idea what was happening. And then when Jim read me the license plate number and I called it in, now we're starting to think, boy, something serious. So what I did was I called John Farrar, who at the time, he was a former Navy skin diver, and he also was working at the Edgartown Turf and Tackle Shop. And he came over with his equipment, and Lawrence Mercier came with him. He was an amateur skin diver.
On that, Bob, I'd like to play some sound from an interview with John Farrar. He was the diver from the fire department that you mentioned, about what he saw when he approached the car when it was underwater. This is from People Magazine's podcast on Chappaquiddick called Cover Up.
So I went around to an open window on the right rear side and put my head through inside to see what we had in there. And at that point, I saw Mary Jo with her face pressed up into the footwell to avail herself of the last air remaining to her.
So what happened next?
John Farrar dove down and was underwater for just a short time. And he came out of the water dragging Mary Jo's body. As far as I remember, he had put a noose around her neck so that he could, you know, pull her out of the car. And I don't know whether he came out through a window or was able to open a rear door. But when he brought the body to the surface, they put the body into a little skiff. Now, the car was only probably 25, no more than 30 feet from the beach and the dock. And they brought the skiff with the body in it over to the beach. Now, back in those days, we had no ambulances like they have today. We all on Martha's Vineyard had station wagons, and every station wagon had a litter in the back because we acted not only as a police cruiser, but as a local ambulance for our town. I had taken the litter down to the edge of the beach, and we lifted the body onto my litter, and then we carried the body up to the, not too far away, 10 or 15 feet, up to the dirt road that led to the dike bridge. Mary Jo had black leotards on, and she had a white blouse. Every single button was buttoned. Mary Jo was a petite little girl. Now, when Dr. Mills, the acting medical examiner, arrived, and I was standing there watching Dr. Mills press on Mary Jo's chest cavity, and water flowed out of her mouth and nose, and I was throwing up my breakfast because I had never seen such a sight as that.
Bob, you hadn't even known before John Farrar brought the body out of the water that there was a body in the car. Now you're seeing this horrific sight on this young woman. You're vomiting. What's going through your mind? How do you feel? What are you thinking about? What's going through your mind?
Well, there were so many things going on, and you know what? I have an excellent memory of the majority of things that have happened in my life. But, you know, I can't tell you. All I could say for my limited medical knowledge was that with Mary Jo, water coming out of her nose and mouth as such as it did, I assumed that she had drowned. And that's what Dr. Mills had assumed at the time.
Bob, Jim Arena passed away earlier this year. In the Boston Globe obituary for him, they recalled what he told reporters that day after Kopechne's body was pulled from the car. He said, quote, "I am firmly convinced that there's no negligence involved, but the matter of the time period after the accident, there is, in my eyes, a violation concerning going from the scene, leaving the scene," unquote. What's your reaction to that comment from Jim Arena?
Well, I can tell you this. I would assume that if he had reported it right away, he knew that he was inebriated and he would be charged with driving under the influence.
Ted Kennedy was eventually given a suspended sentence on a charge of leaving the scene of an accident. He maintained that he had not been drinking before he drove the car, and there was no immoral conduct between him and Kopechne. He emphasized that in a speech the week following. Let's listen.
"There is no truth. No truth whatever to the widely circulated suspicions of immoral conduct that have been leveled at my behavior and hers regarding that evening."
Bob, do you think justice was served for Mary Jo Kopechne and her family?
No. I think he should have owned up and told the truth, but politics was running through his mind, and he wanted to be president to carry on the family tradition. And when I saw the senator back at the station around 10:30 that morning after we brought the car back, he had on a light blue lacrosse t-shirt, and it was inside out, and I will never forget that.
Bob, is there anything you wish anyone in law enforcement would have done differently back then or on that day?
Well, I would think that the girls should have been interrogated. Those girls were whisked away. None of them were interviewed at all. But don't forget, you were dealing with a U.S. senator, and I'm sure he was extended certain privileges, okay, which is only natural. And he was whisked away, and Bobby Carroll's, who was a selectman and a local boy, and he volunteered to take the senator and his cousin and one other person off the island, and there was no interrogation of anybody as far as I know.
That's Bob Bruguer, one of the officers at the scene the day they recovered Ted Kennedy's car and Mary Jo Kopechne's body in Chappaquiddick. Bob, thanks so much for joining Radio Boston.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, the first reporter to interview Senator Kennedy after the crash. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. This hour, we're reflecting on Chappaquiddick. 50 years ago today, Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy drove his car off a bridge on Martha's Vineyard. Kennedy survived the accident. His passenger, 28-year-old Mary Jo Kopechne, did not. Before the break, we heard from Bob Bruguer, who was a summer patrolman for the Edgartown Police and one of the first people on the scene. Back in Washington, in the days and weeks that followed the crash, one of the conversations became, were Senator Ted Kennedy's larger political ambitions over? Here's Kennedy speaking in a televised statement to the nation on July 25, 1969, entertaining the notion that he should resign.
"And so I ask you tonight, the people of Massachusetts, to think this through with me. In facing this decision, I seek your advice and opinion. In making it, I seek your prayers, for this is a decision that I will have finally to make on my own."
Kennedy ultimately decided to stay in the Senate, and the voters of Massachusetts kept him there until his death in 2009. But in the immediate days and weeks after Chappaquiddick, Matthew Storin was a young reporter for the Boston Globe covering Kennedy. He went on to become an editor of the Boston Globe. At the time, he was in Washington and landed the first interview with Kennedy after the crash. Matt, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Matt, how did the news of the accident and of Mary Jo Kopechne's death land with you and with Washington?
Well, it was a very hot Saturday in Washington. Most people, of course, had the day off. I had taken my now three older children, I had one after that too, to swimming in a public pool. And just as I got home, I think I was just getting out of my wet bathing suit when my phone rang. And it was my bureau chief, Boston Globe bureau chief, Jim Doyle, who had heard, we had sketchy details. What he knew was that the senator's car had been found upside down in the water and that there was a dead woman in the car. And he knew her name and he had gotten her address from a source on Robert Kennedy's former staff. And so he wanted me to go check out that home.
This was after the assassination of his brothers, both President John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy.
Yes, you really have to keep that in mind, of the state of mind of the public, not everyone in the public, of course. There have always been a good number of people who didn't care for the Kennedys politically or personally.
And what was Ted Kennedy's standing in the Kennedy family landscape at that time?
Well, it was actually, in hindsight, remarkable. There was just no question that Ted Kennedy was the likely nominee for the Democratic Party going into the presidential election of 72. Now, we're still, of course, in 1969. We're 3 years shy of that. But he got enormous attention. The Kennedy family at that point was, you know, revered generally by the public, especially because of these tragedies.
So, Matt, given that, what were reporters saying to each other? What were politicians and staffers saying to each other? What was that conversation like once the news hit in Washington?
Generally, it never got any better than what it was within those first 24 hours. Once it was clear that he had been driving the car, which, as I indicated, that was not immediately clear that Saturday afternoon. Everyone figured this was going to be politically fatal for Kennedy. Remember, at that point, we don't know whether he's going to wind up in jail, charged with manslaughter or something. So there was a very, very negative impact.
Matt, as we mentioned before, you were the reporter who landed Kennedy's first interview after the accident. We
Yes.
pulled up that article from 1969. What did he say and what was he like in that interview?
Well, it's interesting. And again, putting things in context, you have to remember that I was a 26-year-old, very competitive Washington reporter. I was determined to get that first interview, and he was gone for almost a month. The Senate had been in recess, so he comes back. And he spoke to me. He said he just wanted to talk off the record. We discussed a number of things, but what he said and what I later negotiated to get on the record was, I can live with myself. And he said he felt bad about what had happened. I don't have that quote right in front of me. He later discussed things kind of as on background about whether he had swum across the channel, which was one of the question marks on his behavior, whether he was drunk. He was not. He was pretty calm. He was actually calmer than the last time I had seen him, which actually was the morning of the accident. That day, he even said maybe to one of my colleagues, God, he was very agitated about something, not about me or anything I asked him, but he was kind of wringing his hands. You know, he had kind of that white knuckle look.
So, Matt, ultimately, your article, Kennedy, I Can Live With Myself, ran on August 14th. How do you feel his attitude then compares with powerful people accused in the Me Too moment today, or with our political leaders now when controversy is revealed about them?
A lot of times, of course, they don't say anything. They duck the press. But today, the power and immediacy of social media and cable television is enormously different. I mean, I cannot imagine if the circumstances that I was just recounting in 1969, August 1969, were to occur today, when he got out of his car at the Senate office building, there would be a swarm of cameras and reporters. That just didn't happen then. Nobody had talked to him before I saw him that day and called him off the Senate floor. Remember, at this point, he'd already gotten off legally with a suspended sentence of 2 months for leaving the scene of an accident, etc. So he knows he's not legally vulnerable in terms of what he says. He certainly knows that he's politically vulnerable. So today, in the Me Too era, I don't think he would have shown up, to tell you the truth.
Matt, looking back over the intervening 50 years, Kennedy's long career in politics after Chappaquiddick, what impact did the incident have on him and on the Kennedys?
That's a really interesting question. Outwardly, he didn't act or behave any differently in public. You know, he did go through a period in the 1980s, the late 1980s, when clearly he was drinking heavily, chasing women around, apparently. But I know that he seemed to realize that he had to assert himself in the Senate, that that was his only hope, even though he did run for president and ran poorly in 1980. You've got to think that eventually he wanted to make his mark as a legislator and perhaps to try to make up for what had happened to Mary Jo Kopechne, not that it could ever be made up from her family standpoint.
There's a lot of criticism out there with this perception that maybe the media and even voters let Kennedy off the hook. What do you make of that criticism?
I think it's to some extent true. Now, it needs, as so many, quick conclusions do, it needs some nuance. I know that the Globe Spotlight team, I think, twice investigated Chappaquiddick. There were many negative stories written about Chappaquiddick, so that's not the point, but it was clear to me even then that with his standing, you have to be aware of time and place. Here you're in Massachusetts, two of the most beloved people in the state, JFK and Bobby Kennedy, have been murdered. And this is the surviving brother. And he definitely lived with fear of being shot at himself. Everyone who covered him knew that, a backfire of a car and he would cower some. There was no way they were going to send him to jail. And there was no way, I think, that the people of Massachusetts were going to destroy his political career. Did they have the same view of him that they had before Chappaquiddick? No. You have to look at press coverage in two ways. As we see really today with Trump, there are certain personalities that attract eyeballs and listeners and viewers. The Kennedys were always news. We wouldn't be talking now, 50 years later, about this event if that were not true. So, yes, there was always a lot of attention, and many of it, kind of neutral. If he had a new program for education or if he was campaigning against Robert Bork and Supreme Court nominee, which he did very vociferously, that made news, and people didn't necessarily bring up Chappaquiddick when that happened. But when there was a large profile done, those things were never forgotten.
Matt, do you think Mary Jo Kopechne and her family got the justice they deserved?
No. I mean, I don't. I think they did get some money, but there's no way that you could compensate for the loss of life. I met her very briefly once. Seemed like a very nice young woman. I think she was leading a pretty good life. I know the house where I went to talk to her housemate was a very nice place, on the edge of Georgetown. I'm sure that they were absolutely devastated. And how could they ever recover from that? No, there's no way that there was no justice for the Kopechne family. And frankly, even if he had been, he wasn't going to be charged with murder, right? So let's say he was charged with manslaughter and had to actually serve, say, 6 months, maybe a year in jail. Would that have been compensation for the Kopechne family? I don't think so.
Finally, what lessons do you think we can take away from the events of July 1969?
I think that oftentimes, our heroes have feet of clay. They're human beings. They're susceptible to errors of judgment. And you learn a lot about a person's character in a situation like that. you know, you could just never forget that when a life was on the line, when he was under intense pressure, and there were mitigating circumstances, the things that had happened to his brother and the public eye that was on him, he did not, unfortunately, live up to expectations.
Matthew Storin is the former editor of the Boston Globe. Matt, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll take your calls on how you're reflecting on Chappaquiddick. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Give it a try. 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. All this hour, we're reflecting on the 50th anniversary of the Chappaquiddick incident. On July 18th, 1969, Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy drove his car off a bridge, killing 28-year-old Mary Jo Kopechne. So far, we've heard from Bob Brugger, a first responder at the scene that day, and a Boston Globe journalist, Matthew Storin, who covered Ted Kennedy and his career from Washington. And now, we want to hear from you. How are you remembering Chappaquiddick 50 years later? How are you reflecting on Ted Kennedy and his leadership in Massachusetts after the event? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. With me in studio is Thomas Whalen. He's an associate professor of social sciences at Boston University, and he's the author of two books on JFK and the Kennedy family. Welcome, Tom.
Glad to be here.
Also with us is Boston Globe columnist Joan Vanacki. Joan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So, Joan, Tom, you've just heard from both a police officer and a reporter who were there. What are your reactions to what you heard?
Well, my reaction is it's the people who were there that really can tell the truth about what happened. And I hope more of them come forward, because just listening to those accounts was really, it sent a chill down my spine.
It did, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Tom?
Just how big a tragedy this really was. You know, a 28-year-old woman who was a very well-respected political operative in Washington, D.C., lost her life, and we still don't know exactly why she lost her life. This is a tremendous tragedy that has never fully been addressed.
So it's interesting, and I want to turn this question to either of you who wants it. I would argue that many times over the last 50 years, the framing of this moment would not have been tragic loss of Mary Jo Kopechne. It would have been story of Ted Kennedy. So what's changed over 50 years that's now really part of how we're remembering and experiencing the Chappaquiddick incident?
Part of it is, I think, that after 50 years, she's finally getting her due as a person. You know, she's not just the girl in the car. She's this young woman who was part of she had a political career. She was one of the first female political consultants out there in Washington. She had all this promise. And in the past, as you said, we've cast this as the end of Ted Kennedy's dream to be president. It was really the end of her dream for the rest of her life.
That's a very profound point. Mm-hmm. Like five thoughts just crashed into my head at one time because you really got me with that. What I wanted to ask was, we have this moment where both 50 years ago and today, because that's how time passes,
The Chappaquiddick anniversary coincides with the moon landing, which was widely considered, you know, driven by and one of the great accomplishments of Ted Kennedy's brother, President John F. Kennedy. How do we make sense of the coinciding of these anniversaries then, now? Tom?
Well, it's kind of like the yin and yang of the Kennedy dynasty, you know, arguably the greatest legacy of President Kennedy's administration, but at the same time, the lowest point for the political dynasty because Ted Kennedy, basically, his political future, any hopes of returning to the White House are gone. And it shows, I think, in vivid terms, there was a dark side to this Camelot political myth that had been so carefully engineered over the years.
What do you think? Do you reflect differently on Chappaquiddick now than you did a few years ago, or if you're old enough to remember it, than you did then? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's talk to a couple callers. Will from Lexington, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I was happy to sit sailing across the Sound, Nantucket Sound, when I heard about it. So I landed about 10 hours afterwards at the ferry landing there where you could come across the Chappaquiddick. Then I walked down the road to the site. And the thing that impressed me was, number one, the land that you're walking on in Chappaquiddick was probably 4 or 5 feet above the tide line. And as you just as you got to the bridge or just before it, the land drops down a little, about maybe 2 feet. And so it was interesting that you thought of Kennedy driving down there with his headlights on, and it would show nothing about the sudden turn. And suddenly here the car drops down 2 feet, and then right away is this bridge off to the left, about an angle of about 45 degrees. There's nothing on the bridge. There's a big log on the side, and you can see where Ted Kennedy had slammed on the brakes. You could see the skidding marks of the wheels, and then you could see a scrape over the log where the car went over the log, and then the car was gone by the time I got there.
Well, that is so that's so vivid. You were right there. You're seeing all this at the time. What are you thinking? What are you thinking about? What happened? What's on your mind when you're looking at all this?
The thing is, first of all, I'm a Kennedy lover. John Kennedy was my hero. I was a Navy person 2 or 3 years behind him and all that stuff. And Bobby Kennedy, I used to see in school, at college. Occasionally, we would just nod at each other. I didn't know him well. So I didn't know Jack or Bob. And Teddy, I didn't know at all. But that was my background. I was a real Democrat.
Yeah. Will, thanks for calling in. Those are just such vivid images from that day. Tom from Mashpee, tell us what you called in to share.
Yes, this is from Ashby.
Thanks. Anyway, thanks for that correction.
Yes. Remembering back at that time period, I'm in my 60s, I was just frustrated when I see all these news reports of so many other people in that drunk driving situations where they killed their occupants, killed their pedestrians, and just, you know, and all they would do is they'd lose their license for a few months, and basically they're right back on the road again. I had a neighbor that one time who they lost a husband and a father due to drunk driving, and the driver was right back on the road again, and he didn't even have any, you know, special connections that we know of. So that it wasn't just the bigwigs that were getting off with drunk driving terrible accidents like this, but almost everybody else, until we finally woke up as a country and said, hey, this has got to stop.
Thanks for that, Tom. So, Joan, both our callers talk about sort of how they were thinking and feeling at that moment. It was kind of a cultural moment where some of it was that we weren't awake to things like drunk driving. Some of it might have been more specific to who the driver was. What do we need to understand about the cultural moment of that time, do you think, as we reflect 50 years later on Chappaquiddick?
Well, I think the first caller made that point by talking about just the ambivalence about the Kennedys, the hero worship that was a part of that era. You're talking about 1969, obviously 6 years after the assassination of JFK, just a year after Robert Kennedy's death. People were still caught up in Camelot and thinking that the torch could be passed to Ted Kennedy. Then this happens, and they're not sure how to process it. There's a feeling that, more than a feeling, he got away with something. And I think the first caller just reliving the physical part of Chappaquiddick. Just coincidentally, I happen to rent a house on Chappaquiddick every summer. And if you go down that path, even today, it's just eerie, even though the bridge is different and things have changed. And you also realize there'd be no way you could make a wrong turn.
Oh, it seems clear to you that one wouldn't make that mistake.
Really clear.
Tom, what's your reaction to that?
I agree with Joan. But we see here in stark terms, you know, how privilege and entitlement works. You know, the Kennedys were the Kennedys. You know, they were this superstar family, kind of like what the Trumps are today, right? And, you know, they thought they operated at a different set of rules. And I think the Chappaquiddick tragedy, we see that because any other just regular person would have been kind of hauled up on much more serious charges. So I think the perception that Ted Kennedy got away with something, I think, is pretty accurate.
So I was going to do this later, but I can't resist. Okay. We have some tape of Donald Trump when he was a candidate in 2016. You're going to get it when you hear it. Let's listen.
And you know what else they say about my people? The polls. They say I have the most loyal people. Did you ever see that? Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible.
Now, I want to point out two things. One, Donald Trump has not shot someone, nor did Ted Kennedy. And two, there was an air of jest, at least to the audience, as you hear them laughing. But there is a sense of not just impunity of power, but that my people love me so much that they're going to forgive me. Was that the case with Massachusetts voters and Ted Kennedy?
I think it was a combination of love, hero worship. And also, he went on to advocate for causes. He was the liberal lion. He stood up for health care, for immigration reform, for civil rights, for causes really dear to people. So they were able to say, listen, I may have some questions about his character or things that he's done in his life, but he stands for the things I believe in. Therefore, I continue to support him and vote for him.
So, Tom, did that dedication to the causes that were so important to people in Massachusetts redeem him over time for what was at the very least a tragic accident that killed someone and he was the one behind the wheel? And some would claim even worse than that.
Well, I think what Jones said is correct. But also, he was very good in bread and butter bringing home the federal bacon in terms of federal grant money. And this was a point in time when Massachusetts was going through this economic renaissance. For most of the 20th century up to that point, it had been a political and economic backwater. But now by the late 60s, early 70s, you know, we're having the beginnings of 128, the high-tech belt, high-tech industry, and Ted Kennedy was an important part of kind of providing the federal funding to get those things moving economically. So I think people were willing to look the other way across a broad spectrum of classes.
What do you think? Did you forgive Ted Kennedy for this incident because of his dedication to the voters of Massachusetts in the years after? Call us and tell us what you think. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sharon from Burlington, Massachusetts. Tell us what you think.
Hi. I did forgive Ted Kennedy. Can you hear me?
I can. You go right ahead, Sharon.
Okay. I did forgive Ted Kennedy. I was young when Chappaquiddick happened, and it just seemed like, you know, everybody was forgiving him. And recently I've read more information. I've listened to podcasts about it, and it was a horrible, horrible cover-up by the whole Kennedy machine and family. To the point where even the Kopechnys, you know, went along with it and just seemed to forgive him. It was just incredible how the whole thing turned around. And so that's all. It was just a big juxtaposition from, you know, what everybody thought to really what seemed to have happened.
Thanks for that, Sharon. I'm going to pull in another voice, Avery from Worcester. Avery, what's on your mind?
Hi. I have to say I was too young when the incident happened, but my mom was alive, and she's always had the utmost respect for Senator Kennedy, and I have as well. It was hard listening to the graphic details about how they found her body, but it makes me wonder whether he tried to redeem himself specifically and do those wonderful things socially because of what he was guilty of. At least ostensibly guilty of.
So Avery, right. Thanks for that. And we heard, you know, we heard in that second mm-hmm. section from Matt Storin, the journalist who said, who talked about sort of Kennedy's behavior in the 80s and suggested yeah. that he thought maybe he was haunted by that. I want to turn to the two panelists, but I want to grab two pieces of sound before I do. The first is from the late police chief Jim Marina, who spoke with People Magazine's podcast on Chappaquiddick called Cover Up. And it's about his feelings years later about failing to get a full interview with Kennedy and to interrogate others before Kennedy left the island.
I never should have let him leave the island, but yeah. Well, these are all things that came to roost, but I thought I would see him again. I really did. I guess I was screwed on that one.
And then one of our callers mentioned that she felt like even the Kopechne family was prepared to sort of give, I don't want to characterize it this way, a pass, but was prepared to be gentle and forgiving to some extent. Let's listen to a quick answer from Gwen Kopechne. This is from an AP news presser in December of 1969 about Kennedy's recollection of the accident.
Are you satisfied with the senator's explanation?
Well, yes.
Mrs. Kopechne?
Yes.
Okay, so both parents there saying yes. Tom, what do you think?
It just shows, like, the power, the aura around the Kennedy family. They were the sainted Kennedy family. But I think as time moved on, as perspective kind of got hold, people began to see the tragedy for what it was and who Ted Kennedy was, because he had some really abhorrent personal behavior in Washington, D.C. and here in Massachusetts that was frankly scandalous, and it caught up to him by the late 1980s.
So, Joan, you wrote a reflection back in 2009 after Ted Kennedy passed away. I'm going to read you a quote from that. So, quote, "In the end, Kennedy shouldn't be judged by his greatest achievements nor for his greatest blemish. He should be judged as a man who returned to the arena no matter what. In victory, he did not stop fighting. In tragedy, he did not give up. He did not succumb to weakness, including his own," end quote. That was 10 years ago. Is that how you feel today?
Not exactly.
So what's different? That's what I was wondering.
Well, first of all, immediately after people die, you tend to have a rosier glow when you're writing.
And I'm not sure that's inappropriate, by the way.
Right. I don't think you should be judged by, you know, all your blemishes. And he did have a chance to redeem himself. But as everybody has said that you've posed the question to, did Mary Jo Kopechne, did she have justice? Did her family have justice? The answer is no. The answer is she did not. So he was given a chance to redeem himself and live a better life. She didn't get it.
I want to talk more about Mary Jo Kopechne. We've thought a lot today about her presence in this story. We mentioned Gwen Kopechne, her mother, earlier. She told the Boston Globe, quote, "Sometimes I'd like to scream a lot, but I'm trying to hold it back," end quote. But the Smithsonian Magazine also quotes her saying that she didn't understand why Kennedy's aides, Joseph Gargan and Paul Markham, who also tried to get Mary Jo from the car after the accident, didn't report the accident or make Kennedy report it, adding, and listen to this, quote, "This is the big hurt, the nightmare we have to live with for the rest of our lives, that Mary Jo was left in the water for 9 hours. She didn't belong there," end quote. Tom, was the big hurt lost in all the sound and fury about the senator?
I think so. And again, it's so unseemly now. But again, that's how power works, that you can cover up such things. And at the same time, when this was all going down, Ted Kennedy had gathered his brother's former aides together, people like former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara and speechwriter Theodore Sorensen. And basically, there was no thought given to the victim here, Mary Jo Kopechne. They were basically there to tell Ted, this is how you're going to resurrect your political career. And that, to me, is probably the most unseemly aspect to the entire tragedy.
We want you to call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tell us what you think about Chappaquiddick 50 years later. Let's go to a call. Bobby from Concord, what's on your mind?
Hi. Yes, I was in graduate school at the time, and I watched Ted Kennedy make his plea to the voters. And I felt very strongly that it was politically expedient and that he wanted to have us vocalize our support for him. And I resented that. And in the letter, I said, you know, you're really the only one that can make this decision. You're the one that knows what happened. And for you to just want us to put the imprimatur on your political future is reprehensible. And I remember getting a response from his staff, and they must have assumed that I was saying, yes, go forward, because on the envelope, they had written the word yes, and then with a big question mark, and I had gotten a letter that basically said, thank you for your support and affirmation and the rest of it. But I really felt that he really was just attempting to ensure his political future by knowing that the voters would support him.
Thanks, thanks, Bobby. You know, that's such an interesting picture of the back and forth, the dialogue that Kennedy was having with his voters. Let's take one more call now. Ernie from Barnstable, tell us what you're thinking.
So I first say a shout out to my good friend, Joan, and I totally agree with her commentary to this point. I think that, you know, what he did was obviously reprehensible. But I also think that over the course of his career, he got his penance, and he paid for it dearly, not just with the lack of the presidency, but over time. And I think people knew what he went through. And I admire him in his later life. I don't excuse what he did, but I think people have to take his whole life into consideration.
Thanks for that, Ernie. Joan, obviously after that shout-out, I got to turn to you. And I'm just going to add something to Ernie's point and then ask you. You know, in some other circles outside of Massachusetts, Kennedy was a really polarizing figure. And in some conservative circles, he was intensely disliked in those years in the Senate after Chappaquiddick. How much did he pay the price of Chappaquiddick? How much was that kind of dislike assigned to Chappaquiddick, and do you believe that it really did cost him his presidency?
Well, from what I read in history books and people who know more than I do about that, yeah, it does seem like it cost him his presidency. In terms of people not liking the Kennedys, I mean, imagine if something like that happened today. It would be headline news on Fox News. It would never go away. You know, blogs, the media, Matt Storin mentioned this, the whole way things are covered today are so different. It could never unfold the same way. The cover-up couldn't last as long as it did. There'd be cell phones, you know, taking pictures of things. There'd be people calling information in. I just think that the whole secrecy that surrounds it, we're just finding out the grisly details now. I don't think that could happen in today's environment.
Tom, do you agree? Because I'm just thinking about the fact that Jeffrey Epstein is facing a bail hearing, or did today, and the crimes that he's being accused of were 12 years ago. So that was a cover-up that lasted a pretty long time.
But we live in such a divisive society that at least 50% of the society condemns those kinds of reactions. And also, Chappaquiddick, it was the beginnings of the large-scale women's movement in this country, empowerment. And in this Me Too moment, there's no way Ted Kennedy would have been able to survive that, I think, in this 24/7 news cycle, as Joan said. But also, you know, I think back to 1980 when he ran for president against the incumbent Jimmy Carter. When he was on the campaign trail, he'd get catcalls as like, "Where's Mary Jo?" And,
wow,
you know, that was hung around his neck, justifiably so, like an albatross. And a lot about the presidency, at least until the recent election cycle, has always been about personal character. And he flunked that.
So did Trump, what some might say. If I could just speak to the women's issue for one moment.
Do, please.
You mentioned that Paul Markham and Joe Gargan stuck with Ted Kennedy and never revealed the truth. Well, the women who were at that party have never spoken either.
That is a remarkable thing. These women who were at this party and were spirited off the island.
Most of them are still alive, I believe. Yeah. They could still come forward.
And would that be allowed today in the Me Too movement? Quickly.
I think they would be under a lot more pressure to say something.
And I also think it's telling that in Kennedy's speech to the Massachusetts voters about the accident, he referred to Mary Jo Kopechne as a girl.
Yeah, that would not happen today. All right, Thomas Whalen, he's an associate professor of social sciences at Boston University, and he's the author of two books on the John F. Kennedy and the Kennedy family, including JFK and His Enemies, A Portrait of Power. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Joan Vanacki, Boston Globe columnist. She wrote a column this week entitled Chappaquiddick at 50, Ted Kennedy's Long Life in Public Service Was a Privilege of Different Times. Thanks for being here, Joan.
Thank you.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.